I would invite you to, for the next 10 minutes, to respond as you will to each other's presentations before we go to Q&A.
I don't know that I have anything to start off, but I can respond to a response if need be.
Sure.
And I guess I would say the same. I've never met Michael Anton before, and therefore I had no idea what he was going to be saying today. But I thought there was some symmetry between your remarks and mine.
Okay. I'm happy if you know, the more people who can recognize at a minimum the theoretical necessity of the right of revolution to the founders' conception of natural rights and to their regime, the better. So I'd like that opinion to become universal on the so-called right. It will never be because the world's imperfect. What are you going to do? But that's my goal. Just as George Bush wanted to end tyranny in our world, I have set a slightly less lofty goal. I just want to convince a couple of thousand conservative intellectuals that the right of revolution is an integral part of the American founding and can't be removed without crashing the entire edifice to the ground. If I have done that, I don't know, that'll have been a decent thing to have done.
And I guess I would just then add to that that I've been, you know, in the conservative, classical, liberal, libertarian world, the liberty movements for several decades now. And it seemed to me that for all of that time, these groups were looking at the state of America from the macro level. And all of their solutions were at the macro level. And I can just tell you that in the context of my life, I have decided that is the road to nowhere. It's the road to failure. It's just, you know, another meeting of like-minded people complaining and whining about the state of America and offering these glittering generalities as responses to the state of the world. And in my own case, I've made the determination that the way to actually make a real difference in the world, even if it's just a small difference in the world, is to identify a single issue and dedicate all of your time and attention to making a real difference on that one issue. So there's a young man named Alex Epstein who has mastered the debates over energy and has become America's, I think, leading expert on energy and fighting for free markets in energy. And in my own small and modest way, just in the course of the last year, really, have decided to dedicate myself to the K-12 education issue. And in the context of what I'm trying to do, at least, I will say that the only thing I've really done is to catch a wave, right? It was the identification of the fact that that on the ground, on the surface level, that there was a kind of underground movement of ordinary, everyday Americans, mothers in particular, who were leading the charge. And in the last year, I've been writing a lot on the K-12 education issue, but really mostly just in the service of what tens of thousands of American mothers are doing around the country. And I think that sometimes we need to see movements that are developing spontaneously on their own and try and give them a little support.
So I guess I'd say one more thing, Richard, which is if I take what Professor Thompson, if I understand him correctly, he's arguing for a kind of, maybe passive resistance is too weak a way to describe it. There's a certain amount of activity involved, but it's also a certain type of activity that's more passive than active, if you follow me, right? So I'm reminded of Gandhi and how he got the British to leave India over a struggle of some dozen or more years, right? And it worked in his case because, for a number of reasons, because the population of India was so enormous. I don't know what it was at that time, but already something like 500 or 600 million. Because the Raj, the British regime, was very small, very thin on the ground. It didn't have a lot of resources. It could only govern the subcontinent and that large a population with its effective acquiescence and consent. And once that was withdrawn, even in a passive way, the Raj becomes impossible. And we're talking about 1947 when the Brits are completely broke from the war, exhausted, and when the very idea of colonialism itself has been totally stripped of its legitimacy. So it turned out to be, I don't want to say an easy thing, but it turned out to be at least possible to use that strategy. And just could, there's a great scene in the Richard Attenborough 1982 movie where Gandhi, played by Ben Kingsley, says to someone, I forgot which British official, but some senior British official, he says, you know, you will leave. And I said, you think we're just going to leave? And Gandhi says, yes, you will leave. And in the end, he was right. They just left. But what happens if trying that strategy here, and I'm not saying this will happen, I'm saying that you got to think about the possibility. It is certainly a fact that the regime that runs the present United States of America in an anti-constitutional way is a heck of a lot larger, stronger, more numerous, more powerful, richer, has greater tools, technological, security, other tools that the British Raj did not have in 1947, and so is probably in a far stronger position to react against any kind of passive resistance or any kind of active resistance up to a certain point, and won't take kindly. It's not going to just let you go, right? It's not going to just say, well, yeah, I guess you don't like this anymore, so that's cool, but keep in touch, we'll talk. I think it's at least as likely that it'll say no. You know, we're going to make sure that we keep a lid on this thing and we keep the control over you that we have spent a couple generations in establishing, we wish to maintain, and we think it's legitimate and you are wrong and we will be justified. I mean, look at the things they already think that they're justified in doing that flatly contradict any historical or just demonstrable, read the documents, understanding of American liberties. They do these things now as a matter of course and they think they're justified. I don't know that they're necessarily going to let us go in an amicable or even bitter but uncontentious manner. And then what? Right? Well, if the right under discussion has any meaning, it means that you might have to have recourse to some other means, whatever that means is. Or, and let's be clear, I'm just saying, well, I just want to establish theoretical clarity here. Or it means you submit. And that submission could take the form of prudence. Well, we're submitting not because we think it's right, but because we just don't see any other way out, and the attempt will fail and make everything worse. Right? That I can understand and even get behind if that's actually the circumstance. What I do reject as a theoretical matter, at a minimum, is the notion that we're submitting because we're obligated to, or because this is the best of all possible worlds, or because the revolution once accomplished is a permanent thing and can never be corrupted or conquered for within, nor can the state machinery be perverted and used against us. I think that's all of that is false and proven false in operation every day, and the more honest we are with ourselves about that, the better, and the better assessment of our situation we will come to, the more accurate assessment we will come to.
Of one thing I am certain, America's homeschool mothers will not submit.
All right, I will open it up for Q&A and also have the questions on Slido. I wanted to ask one question. I agree with much of what both of you have said regarding the problems in our regime, the constitutional problems. I was thinking about the Declaration. We've got 27 grievances in the Declaration of Independence.
Well, 18, but then one of them is sort of broken out into subcategories, but depending on how you count.
Okay. Well, fine. Thinking about these categories and, you know, abolish laws, prevent self-government, military over civil law, colonists being tried in a foreign location, taxation, consent of the governed being abolished, preventing the legislatures from meeting, and then, you know, the king placing the colonist outside of his protection, opening them up to predation by Indians, things like this, the Quebec government, et cetera, we think of those 27 grievances, that's what actually grounds or gives the Natural Rights Proclamation, the second paragraph, something that is concrete and then embodied in the life of the colonists. And I was just thinking about our present situation. Should we sort of interweave these categories into how we're thinking contextually? If so, how do they apply? And also, I was just thinking, I mean, as an earlier panelist said, conservatives do win a lot of elections. And, you know, hold state legislatures. Even the 2020 election did fairly well. Do we find that condition, the fact that we do seem to win elections at least half the time, conducive to a ride of revolution or calling for a ride of revolution, if in fact we are succeeding politically at some level?
Well, I mean, first of all, as to the Declaration, you know, some of the charges, it's contextual, are not exactly apt to what we're talking about today. Like, there's no quartering of troops. They haven't resorted to that yet. We'll see. We'll see if that becomes a thing later on. Some of them do seem apt and somewhat familiar. And again, I'd say it's incumbent upon all of us to examine what was going on then and examine going on today. And, you know, first of all, we need to each come to our own individual judgment about where we think it is, and then we need to have a debate about it. And I think the debate about it gets constrained by the immediate sort of, you know, denunciation that people to the right have against those on their own side who they think are going outside the lines a little bit. And that's not helpful, doesn't it? It's not helpful. It constrains what we're able to think in a way that will ultimately constrain us coming up with a prudent course of action. As to conservatives winning elections, yeah, they do. My complaint about the conservatives winning elections is they often don't do much with them. I'm sort of sympathetic with them at the federal level because it's hard to do anything at the federal level because the permanent bureaucracy won't let you. Even if you could get your leadership, and I talk to senators and members of Congress sometimes who I think have great ideas and really want to do good things. And then they say, well, you know, I can't get that past McCarthy or McConnell or whatever. And they're not, I don't think they're saying that as a cop-out, right? They're genuinely upset that the leadership has all this power and uses it to bottle up reforms that would be helpful. And I sort of sympathize with that too, and I don't know what to tell them. So I'm more disappointed in the conservatives that win statewide with big legislative majorities and have governors, and they don't do anything with it, or they do dumb things, like Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas completely signing on to all the transgender madness and other stuff in his last year because he knows that the Walmart board wants him to. Now, luckily, the conservatives here, I'm gonna backtrack on my own argument, the conservative state legislature overrode his veto, so God bless. But think of, you know, Kristi Noem caving to them in the same way. I mean, it's very disappointing, and I don't, there's no, where's the excuse for that other than a lack of conviction? So I'd like to see better conservatives win elections at the state, bolder conservatives, more willing to exercise state power and more willing to get into fights, you know, legislative fights, legal fights, political fights, to be clear, with the federal government. But again, if the states were to start to really assert their sovereignty over those issues, which the federal constitution nominally leaves to them, but in practice today leaves them no space at all, free from federal supervision, the feds are not gonna take that lightly or lying down. And the conservative movement needs to be prepared for that and have a plan or have some kind of thought and strategy about how to deal with it, and certainly not revert to, well, you know, there's nothing you can do, or the courts have decided, I guess that's unconstitutional or whatever. And I don't see yet that fighting spirit, which I think is going to need to be, I see only the beginnings of it. It's a little better than it was a few years ago, but it's gonna have to get a lot better if the states are going to be useful vehicles for resisting federal encroachment, and dare I say, you know, mandated federal tyranny, when they just come in and say that because of this administrative rule, you're gonna do that, and that's the end of that. I want to see more states be willing to stand up for that kind of thing and suffer, you know, some political and perhaps even economic consequences for doing so. And I don't see the willingness for them to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, Joe Sullivan from Dallas. I'm a business and financial consultant, and I specialize in difficult transitions and bankrupt and dysfunctional organizations. And if I don't have concrete, actionable proposals for my clients at work, they stop calling me and I have to trim my budget radically. So I like Bradley Thompson's focus here on walking away from the education establishment, in part because I am married to a homeschool mother and I am the father of one. Now, let me add a couple of things. I'll do it with an up inflection to make it into a question, and I would like your response. But there are two or three things that are critical in this that we've learned, absolutely critical in this that we've learned. One is, whatever the state is, and we're blessed to be in Texas, it has to be fully legal to homeschool your children. The teachers' unions go to a lot of trouble to see to it that it isn't. The second thing is, if legal, it must also not be regulated. A lot of people, including our crowd, say, oh my gosh, some of these parents are ignoramuses, bad things will happen, and it's all true. But bad things happen, and worse things, in the school system. When it's regulated, the educational authorities use that as a way to choke out homeschooling, and I could give lots of detail. The third thing, which I just learned about, and my daughter may still be in the room. Are you in the room, Lydia? Yeah. She could tell you the details, but she's now in West Virginia, and in West Virginia, they actually provide school funding to homeschooling families. Now, these are three concrete things that everybody can go home and talk up and say, hey, look, this is great. Homeschooling needs to be legal. It needs not to be regulated because the regulation is an alternative way to stifle it. And the third thing is there are places where they're successfully applying funding, sharing the funding with homeschoolers. To make it a question, what do you think of that?
I like one, two, but I don't like three. So I support legalizing homeschooling, which ought not to be have to be legalized in the first place, but homeschooling should be entirely legalized. There should be no, I don't support any regulations for homeschooling at all, but I do not support the government in any way funding homeschooling parents. And the reason I don't is obvious, because wherever government money goes, government goes. And wherever government goes, government regulations come. And the one thing that cannot and must not ever happen is for homeschooling to be regulated in any way, shape, or form. So, and, you know, and which is why, for instance, even though I did have one passing reference to charter schools, in the end, when push comes to shove, I'm not a supporter of charter schools for the very same reason, or for vouchers. I support a complete separation of school and state. If you do not want the government regulating Sunday school, why would you want the government regulating school Monday through Friday? I want government out, period. I want a free market of education.
I don't know. I guess I'd be more sympathetic to the possibility. To me, it's not the principle of government funding it. It's which government and to what end, right? I mean, we used to have pretty strong public schools throughout this country that taught patriotic civics education, the sound fundamentals in reading, writing, arithmetic, and good morality, and began every day with a prayer. So all paid for by taxpayers. That proves that it's possible. It's obviously not possible with the government that we have now, but maybe it's possible at the state level, where you look to other countries where, you know, the Hungarians, for instance, are putting a lot of money into education. I don't know that the answer is a permanent cleavage between government and education so much as it is the problem is with the nature and type of a government that we have now. I'd rather just have a better government whose aim was the uplift and improvement of its citizens rather than the whatever the aim of the current government is, let's say the taxation and despoilation of its citizens. And then if I had the former rather than the latter, I'd probably be encouraging that government to get more involved in education, especially since these poor homeschoolers are all paying taxes for a public school that they're not using. So, you know, getting a little of that back might help offset that.
From the day government education was instituted in 1852 in Massachusetts going forward, government education has always been by and for the state, period. Any history of the creation of the government school system going back to the 19th century demonstrates clearly that it was established on the model of Prussian education. And the goals were to make young children, and I'm essentially paraphrasing what was actually written as justifications for the creation of the government school system, to make young children servants of the state.
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's necessary. That's a necessary consequence of government support.
Let's go to the next question.
Has there ever been an education system that didn't do that?
I think the United States, much of United public education in the history of the United States, didn't do that. A servant of the state? No. Capable of operating within the state and living a good life? Yes.
Okay. You ready?
I'm Stephen Smith, and for purposes of this meeting, I have no affiliation. Professor Thompson, I appreciated your reference to Velvet Revolutions, Silk Revolutions, whatever that is. And Havel's great essay, The Power of the Powerless. But it seems that the communist regimes of Eastern Europe lack something that our present regime has, which is total control of information. I'm sure everyone in this room has had details recorded and put in some cyber storage unit somewhere. They know who we are and they know where we live. This is one reason I thought the Benedict option was a little naive, because we can't retreat somewhere and be safe. They can come and get us. We may not yet have begun to fight, but neither have our opponents begun to fight. And Dr. Anton, you mentioned the Raj and its departure from India. Well, the difference between the Raj and our current woke regime is that the Raj was undergirded by fundamental decency and by the scrupulousness that our current masters don't have. You know, it could be that a mass of villagers in East Africa or South Asia could combine with their tools and weapons overcome a man-eating tiger. But who goes first? And unless we go together to fairly mass movement, will this work, yeah. What you suggest? Both of you?
So I'm tempted to answer with a short quote from another movie, half forgotten, called A Perfect Storm, but I like it. There's this fishing boat, and they're out in this horrible storm, and they finally think they're out, and one of the boats says, "Skip," to the captain. "You know, Skip, we made it." And George Clooney is the captain. At first he smiles, we're gonna live, and then sort of darkness comes over his face, and he just says, "She's not gonna let us out." I think that about the blob in a way. She's not gonna let us out. Like they're not gonna just let us go willingly. They're not going to come to their senses and realize out of decency that, gee, we've really been bullies and this has gone too far. In terms of who goes first, that's an interesting question. So just sticking with civil disobedience, okay, forget, you know, if you're going to, and from a military point of view, if you're going to attack a given position with a regiment, right, somebody's going to get shot. Now, the regiment may win, 80%, 90% may survive, but somebody's going to die. Now, since we're not talking about a military, but we're talking about some kind of passive resistance to the regime, right? People are going to go to jail. They're already putting people in jail right now for things that are really not crimes, or that are minor crimes, or that are crimes 1/1000th the intensity of stuff that their side gets away with routinely. So for us to take on the regime in this way, somebody's going to go to jail. Probably a lot of people are going to go to jail unjustly and have their lives ruined and their financial and their savings completely depleted. And to be just really blunt and dark for a second, some people are probably going to die in jail. Are we ready for that? And who's it going to be? Who's going to make that charge first? And it's going to be hard to convince anybody to go first or to go at all. And the regime knows that, and I think that's one of the reasons why they're clamping down and making examples out of so many people. So I'm sorry to constantly harp on the bad, but let's be aware of what we're facing. We're not facing nice people who play by old rules and who want to be fair. I think we're facing bad people who want to be in power above all and are willing to do anything to maintain their power and are willing to do unjust and evil things to you and I in order to maintain their power. And the reason I say that is because they're doing it right now in front of our very eyes.
Which is precisely why the just walk away option, which is the one that I favor, I think recognizes that fact that you have identified, Michael. And it you know, in the end, will it succeed? I don't know. But given very few other options, I'm sticking to it.
I wanted to ask a question from Slido before you go. And it's about the pro-life movement and revolution. I wanted to try and amplify the question. It's the pro-life movement used the electoral process to get anti-Roe judges on the courts. So why does Anton insist that violent revolution is necessary? I know you weren't insisting that. I'm just reading the question necessarily. You know, the pro-life movement, disfavored by every powerful segment of our society, welcomed strangely with open arms or not with open arms by the Republican Party, kept at a distance by many Republican politicians, and yet after decades of making arguments, real arguments, has finally begun to succeed, at least on the court, and now is in the democratic process with the policy. Is there something to be drawn from the pro-life movement and how they proceeded in the face of tremendous opposition for such an important policy principle?
Sure, I'll take any victories wherever they can be gotten. And I'm very pleased that that happened, and I hope to see more such victories out of the court and so on. I think it would be naive to think that the courts at any level, whether Supreme, Appellate, District, you name it, are going to save us. They will win some more victories. But I mean, think of it this way, right? Imagine a price chart, a stock price chart, and the stock is liberty, right? So there's some spikes. It goes up sometimes. But if you look at the 50-year trend or the 100-year trend, it's down consistently. And if you look at just the 100-year trend, or let's say since the Warren Court, the trend in the courts is way down. To get back to where we were when all of this started is going to require hundreds of more victories like that. And if each one takes 50 years, where are we going to be? So I'm all for it. More wins, more lawsuits, more good judges, more. I just caution everybody against thinking that that's going to fundamentally turn things around in a short enough time frame while the regime is actively and speedily working to restrict liberty ever more.
So as a homeschooling father and a member of the Sons of the American Revolution, I agree generally with both presentations, but I also write and lobby on pieces of legislation and work on independent expenditure campaigns for and against candidates. So I want to drive the conversation to that kind of practical activity. One of the challenges that we see in Oklahoma, where all of the craziness is present in public schools, is that when transgender bathrooms come up, what people want, I mean, some people pull their kids out of schools, but what most people want is for us to go in and fix it. And so we do. We get the legislature to pass a law that says you can't do that in your schools. As pornographic curriculum is discovered in schools, that's going to be on the table for the next legislature. And we're going to write some laws, and I'm sure they will pass, that will prohibit those things. But part of what that does is give people a false sense of security that, and I've seen conservatives in Washington State try to put a measure on the ballot to require very specific civics curriculum. You've got to teach Locke and the Declaration, all these things. And I told them, why would you want Marxists to spend more time talking about all of these things, right? That is not going to achieve your results. They were not very happy, but they weren't successful either. And So I'm curious what you think about this at that granular level of legislative strategy and campaign strategy. Oklahoma's the reddest state in the country, but the average conservative there wants the public schools to succeed and thinks that these problems are little one-off flukes. They don't see the trend that Michael just described. So I'd love your response to that. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess my response, and in fact, I think this is true in Oklahoma. We know it's true in Oklahoma, which is, how did that work out for you? Right? You pass all this anti-CRT legislation, and then, as you suggested, what happens is then conservatives go to sleep. They go to sleep. They think, victory, you know, we've saved the schools. And while it turns out the whole time CRT is still being taught. CRT is not going away. You can legislate it, you can try to legislate it out of the schools all you want, you will never get rid of it. It is there permanently. It is there because there is an education deep state. And the education deep state, at the heart of it, are the so-called ed schools, the teacher training institutions. And they are absolutely 100% top to bottom, they are driving CRT. Every single teacher who comes out of a teacher training institution is educated, indoctrinated in CRT. It's all they know. So why do conservative legislators think that they can legislate it out of existence? They can't. And the same is true with critical gender theory, right?
Here's what they could do, though, and they don't. I don't know why not yet. So I'm curious as to why there are a number of states that have Republican control in both houses of the state legislature, in some cases veto-proof majorities, they're not attacking the universities or these education schools. Why not just remove the necessity of an ed school credential to be a teacher? If you have a math degree, you can teach math, right? Start using state-level power, because as much as I'm totally for the homeschool movement, but I think we have to be realistic here and admit, at least this is my estimation, it's not a realistic option for the majority of the population who isn't equipped to do it, who doesn't have time, who needs that job to make money or whatever. Most parents are going to want a functioning school system that they can send their kids to because they just don't have the time, the inclination, the training, the patience, the whatever it is to homeschool their kids. I think the type of person who can do that is very admirable, but also somewhat rare. I don't know what it is as a percentage of the population, but it's not 50, and it's probably not 20. So they're going to have to be some kind of system to teach kids. The question is, what's it going to be? How's it going to be staffed and run? And in places where Republicans have power, they ought to be using that institutional power to shape these institutions. Again, agree, totally. Don't just pass a CRT law and think that you're done and walk away. You got to be constantly riding herd on these places and figuring out what's going on and restaffing them and reshaping the culture. And that's a long generational fight, but I think that's a much better place for conservatives to be putting energies, let's say, over the next 10 or 20 years, than all the stuff that we obsess about at the federal level that is so hard to implement even if you can win a federal election and that gets undone as soon as you're out.
A question from Slido. Can we just walk away from other institutions of the administrative state? And it seems to me we've had talk of the Velvet Revolution. You know, one of the parts of the Velvet Revolution was the government had become so weak and impotent through trying to control everything that you could just sort of walk away from it and it collapsed. Is there any sign of that happening to the administrative state?
No. Not that I mean, I don't. Do you see any? I mean, I don't. I mean, I have some recent experience with the administrative state. I got chased out of it 4 years ago. It doesn't seem to be, I mean, it's incompetent and it's kind of bungling, but it's a weird combination of incompetent and bungling and so powerful and massively resourced that, you know, it looks like a behemoth from the outside and even from the inside. So it could be one of those things that, you know, the collapse surprises you. It sort of, when you, in hindsight, you may look at it and go, well, we saw all the signs and nobody put it all together. But right now I look at it and I go, it could be here for a little while. Well, I don't see where the chinks in the armor are immediately.
Yeah, I don't see the deep state changing in any fundamental way. However, I do think in all kinds of areas outside of government that there are some signs of hope. I mean, clearly, I think the best sign of hope, as I've already made clear, is in K-12 education. But it's also now starting to happen at the university level in higher education. So we are now, just over the course of the last two or three years, we are seeing the creation of new colleges and universities. And this is what conservatives and libertarians need to be doing, and what they claim to do best, which is to think entrepreneurially. So rather than thinking of state solutions to problems, we ought to start thinking of private solutions to problems. And we have seen the creation of the University of Austin in the last year. My friend Stephen Blackwood in Savannah, Georgia, has just launched Ralston College. I've heard of other colleges that have been launched in the last 2 years. The fact of the matter is, over the course of the next 10 or 15 years, a sizable number of colleges and universities are going to go out of business. Demographically, they cannot be sustained, and they are imploding as parents are looking for alternatives. I think about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, a 150-acre college campus with 24 buildings in Vermont. And by buildings, I mean dormitories and administrative buildings, classroom buildings, theaters, athletic facilities, went on sale for $5 million. That is peanuts, right? So what we need to be doing is we really do need to be sort of starting, forget the deep state, forget the administrative state. It's there, it's not going away, we're not going to change it. So get outside of the system and start working and thinking entrepreneurially about creating new institutions from the ground up.
I'll let this be our last question.
Thank you. Daniel Lowenstein, and this will pick up on something that Michael Anton said just a couple of minutes or so ago. Professor Thompson, I wish you all success with this movement, and I hope, I mean, and the mothers who I guess are really the behind it, and I hope you succeed. I hope it spreads to the university more and really has an effect there. But you mentioned five things that are necessary in order to make this successful, and I want to suggest that there is an absolutely essential sixth thing, and it picks up on Professor Anton said, I think correctly, the vast majority of parents just aren't in a position to go off on their own and educate their children. So I would like to suggest that the sixth requirement is strong, massive institutional support for parents and families who want to educate their children outside the public schools. I'll assume for the sake of argument, because I don't want to get into the other argument that the two of you had, that this will, none of them will be governmental institutions, that they will be private. But it seems to me that it is absolutely necessary. So I'd like to ask you, A, do you agree with that? But also, if you do agree with it, could you talk for just a couple of minutes on what kind of support there might be and what kind of support there should be?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by support. Do you mean taxpayer-funded support?
No, I mean privately, whether it's charitable or, you know, just or entrepreneurial, but that something has to be there. They have to have an alternative if they take their kids out of school. I think the majority of parents are not able or willing to homeschool their children. And even if they do, they really need institutional support, right. Some kind of support for that.
I think I'm more optimistic than you are on the ability and the willingness of parents to take responsibility for the education of their own children. But let me just give you two very quick anecdotal examples of how this can be done. In two of the poorest places in the entire world, in Hyderabad, India, and Lagos, Nigeria, where there is government-funded, universal government schooling, 80%, or somewhere between 70 and 80% of all children in the poorest slums in the entire world are privately educated. Now, you might think to yourself, how is that possible? It's possible because in those countries, unlike in this country, they have removed all of the barriers to entry for the creation of schools. And what you've got now in these poor slums are thousands and thousands of small home schools where somebody puts a shingle out on their front stoop announcing the school. They bring in five students. And the fact of the matter is these desperately poor parents would much rather pull their kids out of the free government schools and have them educated in a small home school where they pay a minimal tuition, where parents are making $500 a year, right? So the fact of the matter is, if it can be done in Hyderabad, India, and Lagos, Nigeria, why can't it be done in the United States of America?
All right. Well, thank you. With that, we'll come to an end.